in the English department this year, and I'm hoping Michael Levinson try and help bring attention to the very exciting Institute for the Humanities and Global Cultures, which is sponsoring this event on the humanities and digital age. We're going to be here relatively masterful with ceremonious master of ceremonies today. I interviewed people with all possible haste to move on, and I thought this morning, after very briefly thanking a few people without whom it's not possible, chiefly, absolutely everyone who's seen on the program today who agreed on really irresponsibly short notice to come and participate today, who have my sort of eternal gratitude, without which this would be nothing whatsoever. I also want to thank good folks at IAF and Sarah Wells in particular for helping organize, and as well as the lovely people at the Scholars Lab, Bethany especially, but also Rhonda and Rebecca, who's not here. But without whom I wouldn't have understood what a Patreon number is. That was truly a schooling. So thank you very much. Our panel this morning on access and ownership features two speakers, whom I will introduce very briefly before being quiet and allowing them to present in this order. Anne Houston, who is the Director of Humanities and Social Science Services at Oldham Library, will present. Chair, what your thought is?
Free for All, Open Access and Humanities.
I really like that. And then Jeremy Boggs, who is from the ADD in the History Department at George Mason University, as well as having the truly remarkable title of Humanities Design Architect. Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, great title. At Scholars Lab here at UVA. He will be talking about what the humanities component of open source.
Okay, so as Chris said, I'm Anne Houston from Alderman Library. And before I start, I want to say that I am definitely not an expert on open access. And I think there are probably people in the audience who know more about it than I do, certainly from the perspective of scholarship. But I'm here as a member of the team that developed Libra, which is UVA's open access repository, and as a librarian with a librarian's viewpoint on some of these open access issues. So that's really the perspective that I'm talking from. And what I'm hoping to do today is introduce the basics of open access, a little bit about Libra, and some of the issues that are being discussed and could be discussed surrounding open access in the humanities at UVA, and that we might find a forum to discuss in the future, that I really hope we'll have a forum to continue to discuss. So I'd like to start with a quote from Kathleen Fitzpatrick. She says, quote, "Raising the idea of open access publishing among contemporary scholars produces an immediate and sometimes surprising set of responses, ranging from enthusiasm to anger to befuddlement. The open access movement has a wide range of proponents and an often entrenched opposition, and the depth of feeling on both sides often leaves those scholars in between scratching their heads, wondering exactly what the deal is." I like that quote a lot. So let's start with a basic definition, and this comes from Peter Suber, who has written a lot of very lucid things on open access. And if you just Google Peter Suber open access, you can get to his very brief introduction, and then it links to a longer introduction that he has on open access, which is very useful if you don't know what it is. And he says, open access literature is digital, online, free of charge, and free of most, that's key, copyright and licensing restrictions. Now, open access literature can take many forms, and I'm not going to talk about all of those today, and that's really a big part of the question, is what else can open access mean? But in academia, it's usually talked about in the context of providing access to scholarly journal articles. And in the humanities, we, of course, need to talk about monograph publishing, but most success so far has been with journal articles. And there are really two ways to achieve this, open access journals and open access repositories. Open access journals are those whose contents are freely available without subscription fees or access controls, and generally with traditional peer review mechanisms in place. And there are different kinds of business models to make this work. An open access repository is a digital repository for open access works, and an institutional repository, or an IR, I might refer to it as an IR because that tends to slip out, is one established by an institution for the deposit of the work of the faculty and staff of the institution. And at UVA, the institutional repository is called Libra. and I'm going to talk about how we set that up. So why does open access matter? Well, it matters for two really important reasons. One is that the current system of scholarly publishing inhibits access to scholarly work. And it really inhibits in two ways, through cost and through technological barriers. The cost issue is, as I'm sure many of you in the audience know, journal inflation for library subscriptions runs between 7 and 9% per year. And for journal titles that can cost in the hundreds or thousands of dollars, you can imagine what that kind of inflation does to library budgets. It absolutely decimates them. Humanities journals are cheaper than science journals, quite a bit cheaper, but the inflation is still more or less the same, and it still continues year after year. And the price of academic monographs is beyond the scope of many library budgets as well. So what this basically means is that fewer libraries can afford to purchase access to your work, be it online or in paper. And online subscriptions don't tend to be any cheaper, and they can in fact be more expensive than paper. Scholarly journal publishing is a business, as we know, and one where the authors don't make any profits. It's really the publisher who makes the profits, and there are some publishers that are making a lot of profit. But it also inhibits, the current system inhibits through technological barriers. So through digital rights management, access to these subscriptions is limited to those with institutional or personal subscriptions. And this factor is actually equally, if not more, frustrating for librarians, because to manage these technological rights, these digital rights, we need to create systems of control that are complicated and complex for our users to use and that lead to endless frustration. And if you've ever tried to use the library databases and the Find at UVA button that's in those databases to get from a citation to the full text of an article, you know how clunky that system is. And it's clunky because of the way we have to set it up and make it work, and it doesn't work very well. But the second reason why open access matters, and I think the more compelling and interesting reason, is that open access increases exposure to work. And there's increasing evidence that this is not just the promise, but the reality of open access. That it creates a more open and free exchange of ideas. In science, technology, and medicine fields where open access journal publishing is becoming fairly well developed, there's evidence that open access articles are downloaded and cited more often than traditionally published articles. And that makes sense. If you think about it, if it's free, more people are going to download it. But there's also evidence that they are cited more often, which is very interesting. So they're having a greater impact. There are very few presses that are experimenting with open access monograph publishing, and while this is relatively new, again, there's some feeling that free availability of online open access versions of monographs may actually help print sales, may actually increase print sales. And I'm quoting Maria Bond from the University of Michigan Library, who is in charge of their publishing unit, and she says, although it is too early to report with certainty, it appears that in the majority of cases, book sales are not harmed by free online availability. And this is very interesting. And on a totally anecdotal, personal level, there have been three times in the past year that I purchased a paper version of a book that was available online open access. I started reading it online and found that I wanted a paper version. So it's a very interesting way to look at things. So what progress have we made at UVA in creating an open access program? So far, we have created the Libra repository. And this was created by the library and ITS to provide a service that was requested in the Faculty Senate Open Access Resolution passed in February of 2010. And I'm not going to read this entire resolution here, but it encourages each faculty member at UVA to retain the rights to your scholarly works. When you publish, don't automatically sign those rights over to a publisher when you sign that publishing agreement. Make sure that the agreement you sign gives you the right to place a copy in the institutional repository, and if it doesn't, you can ask for it. You can ask for that right by writing an addendum and seeing if the publisher will agree to it. The resolution also encourages faculty to submit an electronic copy of each article that they've retained the rights to in an institutional repository to be created by the library. So the library created the repository in response to that, although we had been thinking about this for a long time. This is not something that the library just did because of the resolution. We had been planning for it. And a key word here in both of these clauses is the word encourages. And I'll talk a little more about what that means. So this is just a screenshot of Libra. And if we had time, I could demo Libra. If anyone's interested in seeing that later and we have time, I'd be happy to do it. But this is, I think you can sort of see that fairly well. The open access piece went online in the spring of 2011, so just a couple of months ago. And if you log on to Libra, you can add articles, preprints, conference papers, book chapters, and books that you have authored. And it presents a simple interface for uploading these in PDF format. And the only format you can do right now is PDF. This requires agreement to a license that you click on as the author that states that you have the rights to make the work open access and give us the rights to distribute it. So you do have to agree to that license. So you have to make sure that you are able to do that. You have to check that publisher's agreement and make sure you're able to do that. And it's important, really important to understand, and I think this is where a lot of the controversy over open access comes from, that you are not handing your copyrights over to the university. You are retaining your copyrights. And when you deposit in Libra, you give us the right to make your work available for educational, non-commercial use. So you're not giving us any of your rights. You're just giving us the right to distribute it. So this is a complicated issue. These issues are very complicated. And there's a button in Libra that says Learn More. And if you click on that, it goes to the FAQs that my piece of the project was I developed the FAQs with Madeline Wessel, our library in-house counsel, who's wonderful. If you've ever had a copyright question, I see some people nodding in the audience. Madeline is wonderful at helping you puzzle through copyright issues, and she and I worked very closely together on the FAQs, and we'd be very interested in any suggestions for improvement or ways to make them more clear and more helpful. Libra is searchable and browsable, and in the future, we hope that the content will be discoverable through Virgo, our library catalog, and also through a web search such as Google. And it's still under development. There's a lot of things that will happen with Libra in the future. And I don't know if you can see this, but there's a reference to the other two pieces of Libra. Libra will be the open access works, but also electronic theses and dissertations, which we are piloting with the engineering school this fall, and then the ability to deposit data sets, which we've mainly seen as something for the sciences, but I'm going to say a little more later about how that actually might apply to the humanities. And this is a screenshot of the submission screen, which you can see is really pretty simple. You simply fill, it auto-populates with your personal information. You upload your PDF, you add metadata, including an abstract, notes, and keywords, and then you can set a release date. If the publisher has asked you to restrict access for a certain period of time, Libra gives you the ability to do that, so you can make it available 2 years from now or 18 months from now if the publisher requires that. So let's put this in some context. In passing the open access resolution and bringing the repository online, we're following the lead of many other institutions. And this site, I'm not sure how you say that, WARMAP, I think, eprints.org, and I forget what WARMAP stands for, something about repositories, is a list of worldwide open access initiatives, and it links to the repositories and to the text of the initiatives. It's a very useful site if you're interested in these issues. It lists about 70 open access initiatives in the United States, the most recent one being the one at Princeton, which passed, I think, about a month and a half ago. So you can get in there and see, and 70 is a lot, but you can imagine that's not nearly all the major universities in the country. So this is really happening very quickly, but it's not not necessarily every university has a repository. Some institutions, as you probably know, make deposit more or less mandatory. There may be opt-out clauses or waivers that you can get, but more or less you have to do it. And the best-known mandatory initiatives are at the University of Kansas, which did this very early, MIT, and Harvard. And you're probably familiar with the Harvard resolution. Harvard has a very strong open access policy that requires deposit unless a waiver is submitted and approved. And I've linked to their repository here, the Dash repository, and if you look at it, it's got thousands of things in it, which really gives you a good idea of what a repository can look like when it's fully developed with a big body of literature from the faculty of that institution, and you can see what it looks like. But a key thing at Harvard is that they have a big staff of people, to assist their faculty in getting things into the repository. And that's a very important point. They're actively going out and helping faculty get things into the repository. So there are different versions of open access policies and various ways to develop and support a repository environment. Here at UVA, we have the technical staff to create the repository, and I hope Martha doesn't mind me saying this, we have not dedicated staff to it beyond that in the way that Harvard has to really go out and do a campaign to get stuff into it. If authors have questions about negotiating with publishers, we are certainly happy to answer those, but we don't have a large-scale program of assistance. And many, as I know from talking to the people at Harvard, a lot of the questions that faculty have to be answered individually. They're really very specific questions about their negotiation with a particular publisher. And so it can't just be a blanket statement that we put out there. It's got to be a kind of discussion that we have with a faculty member. The good news is that many major publishers are changing their policies to allow authors to deposit a version of the work in an institutional repository, sometimes after an embargo period. And this site that I've linked at the bottom here to publisher copyright policies, the Sherpa Romeo site, is a very useful compilation of different publishers' policies. And you can go in there and search by publisher and see what their open access policy is. So when publishers change their policies, it means that you don't have to negotiate with the publisher to put something in the repository. It's already written into the policy that you're able to do so. So I'm going to finally end with some, well, not really end, but say some things about how is open access relevant to the humanities? And there are a couple of, I think, really key questions here. And the first point is that the institutional repository doesn't create an open access program. It just creates a piece of the infrastructure to enable an open access program. And we know that it's not, if you build it, they will come. IRs are generally underused, except where the institution has passed a mandate and a program is in place to facilitate deposit. So in other words, a lot of libraries have created a repository. And you go in there and there's almost nothing in it. And if you look at Libra, there's not a lot in it right now. There's, of course, we just brought it online. We haven't really started to talk about it. But there's not a great deal of stuff in Libra right now. And I think we have to really question what we can do about that and what we need to be doing as the library. So without a mandate to deposit, I think you're right to ask, you know, why would I use it? And so I think it's very good to have this conversation around these issues and to continue to have the conversation. I found a very interesting article that was published recently by David Seaman, who was the head of the eText Center here at UVA and is now an associate university librarian at Dartmouth. And he interviewed humanities scholars at Dartmouth about their use of Dartmouth's repository. And this study was published in DLib magazine earlier this year. And in his study, he found that humanities scholars were interested in the repository, but they didn't use it. And he tried to find out why. And he found that, first of all, the functionality was not necessarily what they needed. And they expressed a need for data storage and curation, such as for text and image collections that they had that were associated with their scholarly work. So they had generated an article, but they also wanted the repository to store the image or the text collection that went along with that article. So it's really a need for data curation, for data sets of a type that apply to the humanities. The other thing was they needed for the repository to showcase their work. They wanted it to create a public face for their work, for it to feed into their faculty profile pages, make their work more visible, provide statistics on how often their work was accessed and used, They wanted tangible evidence that open access increases the use of their work and their profile. And I think that's a really important point for us as well to think about. So I think that David's study underscores the need for continued discussion between the library and the faculty. The library can't develop the repository services in a vacuum. We need to be in sort of constant conversation with faculty, and I hope that we will continue with that. The second interesting point, can the open access model work for scholarly monographs? There's, as I said, some experimentation going on in this area, such as with the Open Humanities Press is one group that's looking at this. But what really needs to happen for this to succeed on a large scale? There are a lot of benefits to open access monograph publishing. Your book can get out more quickly. You can get something published on a topic that is perhaps not publishable, not marketable, because it's controversial or it's esoteric. But within the traditional academy structure, this is, you know, a pretty radical thing. It can seem like, as one study I read put it, it can seem like vanity publishing. And so we need to get beyond that. How can we make it not seem like vanity publishing and become something that is legitimate within the structure that we have? And what will be the business model for it? Of course, that's a huge question. There's some initiatives where university libraries are taking on publishing programs and absorbing that into their structure. And so the business model is supported by a university library. It's happening, for example, at Michigan. And then the final question, what happens or can happen when a book becomes open access? We know that it can enable new forms of peer review and authorship, and will these be valued? And I'm quoting David Perry, who said, rather than providing the book with a digital facelift for 21st century scholarly communications, academics should move past book-based biases which structure scholarly communications and instead imagine and execute born digital scholarly forms which leverage the evolving digital media landscape. So the book can be something that the book hasn't been in the past. Open access enables that. And interestingly, this quote comes from a book called Hacking the Academy from the University of Michigan Libraries Publishing Division. And this was an online open access book that was created by crowdsourcing. So the editors solicited hundreds of contributions in the course of a week and then compiled them into an online book, which is itself a book about new forms of scholarship and has a section on open access. And I know Bethany has something in that book and others do as well. So this sort of collaborative scholarship can really only be born digital and open access because of the immediacy of these forms that enables. So so I'll just leave it at that. A couple of links that I talked about here. All of these things can be Googled, of course, but I'll leave it at that.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, Aaron.
Thanks. I almost didn't make slides, and then I felt really weird not making slides for some reason. Then I had a whole meta conversation with myself about that. So I made slides.
All right.
So, question, what can the humanities learn from open source? When Chris first asked me to give this talk, he suggested this title, but he also said I could change it to kind of whatever I wanted, but like is usually the case when I talk to Chris or when Chris asks me a question or presents some kind of problem, it got me thinking. And so I was like, this is a great question. I'll try to address it as best as I can. But what I'm really going to do is not what the humanities can learn from open source, it's what I have learned as a humanist who's also works like with open source software, develops open source software, and then maybe we could have a conversation about those things, whether the things I've learned can apply to your work or not, or complicated, or something like that. So to clarify that, the points I make encompass philosophies from both free software and open source software, which for people who don't know, are two very different things. They have very similar takes on software, but it's the emphases, like for each, that matter. Free software, which is promoted by Richard Solomon, focuses primarily on the rights of individual users to see, access, modify, redistribute software the way that they want to. It focuses purely on like the person using the software, working with the software. Okay. Kind of in contrast to that, or somewhat related to that, is the notion of open source software, which really focuses more on the collaborative, open nature of actually building the software. The fact that the software itself can be built by multiple people, that it can grow, that it can actually be improved by many eyes, many people looking at the same source code. So I've also decided to answer this question in a format similar to what Eric Raymond used in his very important, very awesome essay, The Cathedral and the Bazaar. You can Google this. In fact, I think I have a slide for the homepage. Now, it's not the prettiest website on the World Wide Web. That, in fact, is Eric Raymond right there pondering something. But he started writing this essay as he was, one, like, watching the development of Linux, but also, like, thinking about how it could influence his own work. In this essay, he argues that open source software development works more like a bazaar than a cathedral. In a bazaar where openness and community, collaboration, face-to-face conversation are prized over like hierarchy, secrecy, things like that. So the cathedral model for Raymond involves developing software behind closed doors, never releasing software until the development on that is, in the eyes of the developer, like pristine and working and perfect, which of course anybody who works with open source software or even software in general knows that is almost impossible, if not totally impossible to do, right? But the bazaar model, on the other hand, is more like an open marketplace. There's no centralized system for purchasing, for distribution. It's all, based on like people using the software, people going from one area to another saying, I like this part that you've added to the software, or I don't like that, so I'm going to take it out. I'm not going to use it. I'm going to fork it, use it for my own purposes. Open source, Raymond contends, provide the best tools and approaches for software development because of its open, participatory nature. So, any questions about that before we get started? Okay. So here are my lessons. I have four of them, but I think there are plenty more. So the first one, our work should be read, used, distributed freely, reused, remixed as much as possible, if not more than possible. I don't think we have even close to stretching the boundaries of this idea. All right. Eric Raymond, like with software, he actually says that any tool should be useful in the expected way. So someone developing a piece of software, a project, should say, okay, this solves my particular problem. This serves my purpose. But really, really great tools lend themselves to uses you don't expect. That other users say, this is a great tool for my own work, that the developer themselves didn't actually think about. For this to work, explicit permission to actually do that, to investigate that, is necessary. So Bethany Novisky, like for academic work, started a really nice conversation about licensing for blog posts and for other kinds of scholarly output. And she kind of promoted the idea of using Creative Commons licenses that weren't restrictive of commercial use, right? Which some people like immediately were like, that's crazy, I want to be able to make money off of my work, right? But of course, nobody, as far as I know, is making a fortune off of our academic articles and books and things like that. If you are, you should let us know how you're doing that, right? My favorite example of this that Anne mentioned, Hacking the Academy, book crowdsourced in 1 week. The idea behind this was very simple. There's already, and Dan can correct me on this if I say anything wrong, because he was one of the editors. The idea behind this was really simple. People are producing really good scholarship, really good ideas already. They're already on blogs, already making movies, already tweeting about it. Let's have people submit that. We'll look at it, edit it, and repackage that into some different form, right? So he did that. He took submissions, I think, for a week. I think they got about, what, 200, 300 submissions? 330 submissions in the span of 1 week. The volume was on, as you guessed it, Hacking the Academy. The result is, I think, one of the most innovative publishing projects in the humanities, in academia, I don't know, in the last 5-10 years, right? It was an idea, it was an experiment. By allowing reuse, they said your stuff has to be reusable. It has to have, I think, a specific Creative Commons license that, we could redistribute it, we could remix it, we could repackage it to share with others, right? Many of the authors blogged as they already had, but the work also gained like additional venues, additional readers. In fact, it's also the finished project, the actual edited volume, as Ann said, was on Michigan's website. But the original submissions, all 300 of them, are available, each one, on hackingtheacademy.org. Let's get to my second lesson. Before I back up, I'm going to say I don't actually talk much about how to develop open source software in this presentation. All right, that could be a whole other symposium. But if you're interested in talking about that, I'd love to do that. My second point, the right to access this code, this research, comes with responsibility. All right, we tend to take for granted the access that we have to open source projects, right? All the footnotes we have. And like this whole era of black boxes where if I want to figure out how this thing right here works, I could get in a lot of trouble for that. Or at the very least, like I could just nullify my terms of service with Apple, right? That's fine, I've accepted that. I'm like, yeah, sure, I'm not necessarily interested right now in how that works. I might be one day, in which case I'll probably switch phones. I started learning PHP. I didn't take PHP classes. I didn't go read a book on PHP. I started using WordPress, which is a free open source blogging platform. You can go to WordPress.org. You can download the software, install it on your own server. I would start running into things that I wanted to do with it that WordPress didn't just automatically do. And so, I could complain to WordPress saying, I want to do this specific thing. And the WordPress people were like, we don't care. Like, the other 50,000 people who are using our software don't want to do that. And so I'm left with my own agency to say, okay, I got to learn how this code works so that I can get it to do what I want it to do. But the really great thing about open source is that, to me, this is not only encouraged, it's expected. Like, the developers are saying, here's how we built this thing. You go figure out how we do it. If you find something that's wrong with it, some way to improve it, you tell us how to do that. But you have to go look at the source code. Right? We can't just point and tell you where things are. So I would do that. I would spend countless hours searching for one function. That, of course, would lead me to another function, which would lead me to another one, way down deep into the rabbit hole. But finally, I could figure out where things were, and that's really kind of empowering. Now, to me, like, this is kind of similar to footnoting, providing citations for things, right? We all love our footnotes. In fact, if things don't have footnotes, we're like, okay, this is sounds great, but it may be nonsense without that proof, that evidence. But even then, I'm pretty dissatisfied with the way that we're still providing evidence for our scholarship. I didn't make a slide for this. Roy Rosenzweig edited, at the time was a pretty innovative volume of the American Quarterly, Hypertext Scholarship in American Studies, where a few of them made very explicit connections, like very immediate connections between the arguments they were trying to make, and the materials they were actually using to make that argument. They actually provided the images, the primary source documents, in their archive. You just click and immediately get to that. And, you know, I look back on this and like, yeah, this is kind of a quaint idea, but this is really a profound idea that we have not at all explored further in like the 10 or 15 years that we've been doing digital scholarship. And I think there's more room for that. And I'd love to talk about why we're not doing that or whether there are better ways to do it. This gets me to my third lesson. Bug reports and feature requests are two different things. In other words, there's a difference between saying that a piece of software is broken and saying that it doesn't do what I want it to do. Okay? Any developers in the room probably know what I'm talking about. Right? There are users who say, this is a fantastic piece of software, but I need it to, load and understand geotiffs. Right? Now, I bring that up because I work for Scholars Lab, and we're developing a plugin for Emeka called Neatline, which will let people upload geotiffs, among other things, geotiffs to Emeka to actually read and understand that the geographical points in those maps are not just, you know, static points, but they're actually, you know, tied to specific georectified or, you know, geodata. Now, nobody at Scholars Lab said this is a bug in Emeka, right? Because they knew that, you know, Omeka wasn't primarily designed for that. There weren't a lot of people actually working with geotiffs. But at the same time, they saw an opportunity to add a feature to Omeka that other people could take advantage of. In academia, this kind of reminds me of, like, arguments that if an author fails to do X, like they don't consult, you know, some other, you know, author or some other archive or something like that, that their argument fails or that it doesn't work. And that could be true, but it's a better way to say that is, okay, that's a feature. That's like, okay, you've read their argument as is. How does adding these new source materials complicate that argument, right? I think I kind of got that right. I'm still working on that one. That actually gets me to my last point, which is that all these bug reports and feature requests are fantastic, but they're even better when they're actually accompanied by real working solutions. Like, it's not just an idea. It's an idea that, okay, I have tangibly shown you how this idea would work. My favorite example of this, getting back to Hacking the Academy, was that there were no ebook versions of Hacking the Academy. It was just HTML, right? Now, there are a couple of people on Twitter, I guess, who complained about this. They're like, oh, we need an EPUB, blah, blah, blah. But all the material was freely available. And so Mark Sample, instead of complaining about that, instead of writing a blog post that said, oh, this needs to happen, he took it upon himself to go make those. So you can actually go to his site and download, I think, an EPUB, a MOBI, and a PDF version of Hacking the Academy. I'm pretty generally wary, particularly in digital humanities, of kind of critique of existing work without offering tangible solutions to that work. You know, there are plenty of other critiques of Hacking the Academy. I bet Dan probably knows more than I do about some of those critiques. Something like the editorial process was closed. You know, the essays they selected weren't the best ones, things like that. You know, those are pretty legitimate, could be legitimate critiques, right? Well, what's really great about Hacking the Academy and this process in general is that you have the opportunity to go take that source material and prove your point. And I'm pretty sure Dan would actually welcome that. Now, in no way do I think that all these lessons, that these are all the lessons that the humanities can learn from open source. But they're, you know, the ones that have resonated the most with me and the ones that I've, you know, tried to build from, like, in my own work. But in the spirit of free and open source, I hope we can all like kind of explore this question together, basically to make our work better. Even my ideas were. So that's it, I think. Something like that. I mean, I think there's plenty of room for conversation about the restrictions on that, like whether, you know, archives would let you provide like links to scanned documents and things like that. Yeah, and I think there are pretty legitimate concerns there. It's part of that. It's also like really just encouraging other people to either like to recreate your argument or to see if your argument is not right. Like, I tend to think that like that one of the reasons, and you know, this is purely speculation, but I'm going to speculate anyway because this is just a symposium, right? Awesome. Okay. That we're not really exploring that because maybe we're scared of other people to actually do that in a public venue, or in some other way that we tend to think that like we publish our book, our monograph, our article, and this is the like best interpretation of this right now, and to not really make other interpretations easier, I guess, is something like that. I don't know. I'm a naive grad student, so maybe I'm totally off base about that. But I like open source. Like, I think they share this stuff, knowing that they know that the more people that see it, the more bugs that can be exposed, and to make the software better. I was afraid of that. Sorry.
Well, it's just maybe I have a question that extends it. So, what I'm curious about is how would treating humanities like open source change the scholarly culture in the humanities so that it's no longer the lone scholar working for herself, and instead has a more collaborative group.
Like, how would that change? The thing that I'm glad there are more smarter people in the room than I am to answer that question. I'd say concepts of like credit are certainly like we tend to come back like every now and then in the practice program that we're doing at Scholars Lab to really think about how we credit each other or together for our work. I think that's certainly one thing that needs to be addressed. There's been a lot of conversation about like the nature of peer review, certainly like all the stuff that Kathleen Fitzpatrick talked about, and Steve Ramsey has written a lot of great stuff on this too. I agree with Steve. I'll admit to being a Steve Ramsey fanboy here in front of everyone. But like he made this point at the end of I think On Building, is that right? That you said that we should be making as many different things as possible and daring our colleagues to actually look at it and evaluate it. I think like that's what I get out of open source. That here's the work that I've done. It's the best that I can do with what I have. It's my idea. Look at it. What do you think about it?
Just a cool way to get work done.
Say that again?
Well, if people are collaborating on the idea, you could focus a lot on it's just cool to kind of do it this way, but not as opposed to is the result, is the quality, for example, having the academy something that is so superior to what could have been produced by the lone individual?
Yeah. Bethany's one of the smart people smarter than me, so.
Well, I would say there is a change in quality because the quality is a difference, right? So in many cases, it's not a matter of a superior product because it's hard to say what a superior product would be. But it's a product that it has a difference in quality because it would have been impossible without a certain arrangement of intellects, right? A certain interdisciplinary approach that brings, for instance, computer scientists with the methods and the theory that underlies their work together with humanities scholars. So it's a matter of asking new questions, being able to answer them, and a difference in quality in that way. I do think that there's some research on sort of quantitative changes in quality for collaborative projects that can be explored deeply in different communities. But the real question for us often now is finding the research questions that excite different sectors of the community equally in order to have real collaborative partnerships.
Right.
Do you mind if I exercise some editorial judgment and ask Anne a question, which I want to have answered? So, in so much as IRs are institutionally based repositories, what are the strategies for searching across them? Right? So, because it would be great if I could get to the open access version of something through Google Scholar or through through the MLA bibliography. But without that, if I want to use an IR, do I now need to go to the Libra page, or can I get into it some other way? And can I search across, say, Libra and Harvard, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah. There is, and somebody in the room might actually know more about this than I do. I believe there are standards that can allow interoperability of repositories. So they can be cross-searched. But I think right now it's a question of, and I don't think technologically that's hard to do, and certainly the content can be discoverable through Google. That's not hard to do at all. But it's just really a question of there being a critical mass out there of repositories that are doing that so that that kind of search is useful. I think at the moment these are so new and so, so much being formed at the moment that the functionality is not there yet, but certainly technologically it's very possible.
Maybe one more question before we break, and then Steve will be speaking very shortly. Why not?
Yeah, again, for you, Anne, because you tell such a hopeful story, I think. It's a patient story, but a hopeful one.
Yeah.
Slow and steady wins the open access. If we only had more staff, we could broaden participation.
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't speak much about forms of resistance that are maybe more embedded or concerted or self-conscious. Could you say something about that?
Sure. Well, I think, one reason I didn't say more about that or anything else is, I could talk for 3 hours on open access, and I'm not even an expert on it. There's a lot of issues that are going on here, and I think that some of the resistance comes from some misconceptions. There are a couple of sources of resistance. One is a misconception that the author is actually giving up their rights when they put something open access or put it in the institutional repository. I think another is that the, you know, the argument has been somewhat politicized through resistance to the traditional structure of publishing, and, you know, is very anti, let's, you know, stick it to the publishers. And I think that creates some feeling against it. But I think what you're talking about is people feeling that somehow this isn't legitimate. And is that what you're... That, you know, it's not... if you don't publish in a traditional journal, if you publish in an open access journal, or you put it online, open access, that you're not going through traditional peer reviewed, that it's not, somehow it's not going to help your tenure file or do whatever. And I think that's something that simply, you know, I don't really have any insight into that, except that I think, you know, that's why so many open access initiatives keep traditional peer review structures in place. And the whole idea of breaking down those structures is the really radical change that open access could enable, but there has to be a sort of larger shift in thinking for that to actually happen. So I don't know if that, I know that doesn't answer your question, but...
Can I cheat and ask one more question, then we'll go on? So you talked a lot about Harvard, and you talked about the availability of waivers in the face of sort of an institutional requirement.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any idea how many people request those waivers?
I don't. That would be a very interesting thing to find out.
Bethany, sure.
Well, I heard Harvard folks talking about this not too long ago, and the answer that question was asked, they didn't have the stats on hand, but the answer was very, very few, like vanishingly few waivers have been requested. The other interesting thing about the Harvard Initiative is that they had a fleet of undergraduates, they had funding to do this, a fleet of undergraduates, about 100 undergraduates, to go out and work with faculty to sort of comb through their archives and help figure out rights issues and put this stuff in. So that's a level of
And one more question, because that raises an equally interesting question, and that is, to what extent is the focus on institutional repositories and open access about scholarship moving forward, and to what extent is it trying to sort of pick interesting essays from the past that now can go in? So a great essay from 1963, is there any interest in trying to recoup those essays for institutional archives, sort of classics? I mean, can we get Kenneth Brooks in the open sort of open access?
Well, the whole idea behind behind the repository is it's self-deposit, so the author has to put it in there. It's generally the way they work. So the author would have to get rights to do that and decide to do it. And
is there any loopholes in those rights? Because some of these essays would have been published so long ago that maybe their contracts didn't include sort of digital things? I mean, can we go like fleece someone?
No, because generally the contract, you give the rights to the publisher regardless. It just simply says, I hand you my rights. You now own my article. So, but it all depends on that agreement that was signed. And they'd have to go back to that.
I think we should break and reconvene in about 7 minutes or so. Thank you very much, both Jeremy and Anne.